right, welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. We have one case on our 10:30 docket, Ex Parte Jose Moreno. If the clerk will please announce counsel. All right, Mr. Spurgeon, thank you.
May it please the court, Madam Chief Justice, Justice Gardner, Justice Meyer, I'm Steve Spurgeon from Marfa, Texas. It is a privilege to be present here today. I represent Jose Moreno, the appellant, a lawful permanent resident of Mexico, who is currently detained in an immigration prison in El Paso, Texas, awaiting deportation since June 18, 2010. With me today are members of his family, his mom, two sisters, and one of his three brothers and a brother-in-law who have come. We have spared the court the five minor children. So I've been told they were, and they had a good time in Judge Stern's court. In 29 years as a practicing attorney, this is my first opportunity to appear before this court. Everyone in Ms. Spisak's office and staff have been very kind to me. And Madam Chief Justice, I would like to thank them publicly. And Ms. Karen, thank you. Succinct, clear, and explicit. The phrase used by our United States Supreme Court in Padilla versus Kentucky to set forth the constitutionally correct immigration removal advice required of criminal defense counsel when representing a non-citizen concerning a plea bargain offer under the first prong of the Strickland versus Washington ineffective assistance of counsel analysis. Justice Stevens tells us that when the terms of the relevant immigration statutes are succinct, clear, and explicit, a criminal defense lawyer has a duty under the Constitution to say so. When, however, when the law is not succinct and straightforward, and I'm reading from the Padilla opinion, a criminal defense lawyer need do no more than simply advise a non-citizen client that pending immigration charges may carry a risk of adverse immigration consequences. And the Supreme Court goes on to cite footnote 15 in the opinion, which includes states, including Texas, that have an admonishment by the trial court as to immigration consequences. To be clear, Padilla had such an admonishment statute like Texas. And I believe that the underlying basis of what is being brought in Padilla is that it is the lawyer's duty under the Constitution to provide advice to his client, not the court's duty under 2613 of the Code of Criminal Procedure. Jose Moreno, as the habeas evidence shows, was first lawfully admitted on January the 2nd, 2002. That's when he first legally entered the United States. The indictment states that he committed the cocaine possession of a controlled substance offense on November the 28th, 2006, less than 7 years. Succinct, clear, explicit. If, with the court's permission, if I could approach the easel.
Sure. Thank you.
Our immigration statutes were set forth in Volume 8 of the United States Code. 1227, Section 1227 of Volume 8, sets forth the criminal offenses under which an alien can be deported. One of those criminal offenses, B.A., A to capital B, little I, includes any controlled substance offense, saving except for one single possession of marijuana of less than 30 grams. This is a cocaine case. Not a marijuana case, succinct, clear, explicit. This statute
makes Mr. Moreno, a non-citizen, deportable from the United States. Now, in immigration law, when a person has been convicted of a criminal offense, you can't, and if you are arrested, and Mr. Moreno is detained, mandatorily detained, in an immigration case, the immigration judge can't give a bond on a drug case, so he's locked up. He can get deferred adjudication in the trial court and probation, but in immigration, it's an offense that you're mandatorily detained. When you are detained by an immigration court, there is a statute called cancellation of removal, and the old term was called a pardon.
The statute, also volume 8, is section 1229B. And it says cancellation of removal for certain permanent residents. And when it refers to the Attorney General, it's referring to the immigration judge, because they work for the Department of Justice and they work for the Attorney General. They're not constitutionally appointed judges. The Attorney General may cancel removal in the case of an alien who is inadmissible or deportable from the United States if the alien has been lawfully admitted for permanent residency for not less than 5 years. Jose Moreno, has resided in the United States continuously for 7 years. Jose Moreno did not reside for 7 years. Even though he was convicted of an aggravated felony offense, which is possession is not an aggravated felony, he is ineligible for this form of relief. Succinct, clear, explicit. Finally, not only is Jose Moreno subject to mandatory deportation because he's not eligible for immigration relief, also in volume 8, section 1182, it sets forth the crimes that a person commits when they can't ever come back to the United States. Succinct, clear, and explicit. If you are committed of a controlled substance crime, you can't come back.
Where is the statute that says that the deferred is the equivalent of conviction?
It's 11. It's found at 1101A43. It may be section 48. I have it in my brief, and I had intended to bring a chart that says that. Since 1997, I believe it is, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals in a case called Musa versus United States. I've cited it in my brief. It stands for the proposition that a deferred adjudication is a conviction. So I guess it would take four statutes to look at to determine succinct, clear, and explicit removal consequences for Jose Moreno. These proceedings, despite, I'm sure, the wonderful qualities that defense counsel may have in the case, that these proceedings are avoided if you simply read those four statutes. And that will tell a defense lawyer what the circumstances are. In this particular case, I believe there is an affidavit from defense counsel who states that he advised Mr. Moreno of possible immigration consequences. I would suggest to you that there aren't possible immigration consequences. There are certain immigration consequences. And counsel also advised Mr. Moreno to perhaps speak with an immigration lawyer, and I understand he may have given him his name or number. Mr. Moreno's affidavit is not substantially different for these purposes than that affidavit, the defense counsel. The fact of the matter is he says that my lawyer said I'll give you the name of an immigration lawyer after you plead guilty if they try to deport you. Either way, those consequences are succinct, clear, and explicit. And the Texarkana Court of Appeals has recently, may I approach you?
Has recently addressed this issue in Elizondo Vasquez's remaining case, where the bottom line is that a criminal defense lawyer cannot trump his constitutional duties.
What I have taken the time to do for the court is to basically ask this court to adopt the reasonings of your sister courts of appeals that have dealt with similar facts and similar issues. And if I may again,
Madam Chief Justice, to be this first prong, a lawyer failed to advise that the guilty plea would case Salazar versus State, authored by a former justice of this court, Justice Hill. When deportation is constantly clear, duty to give credit and violence to people you include. We've got the Bail of Reyes case that's out of the El Paso Court of Appeals. I understand that the petition has been accepted by the Court of Criminal Appeals in this case. Attorneys should have researched the immigration consequences and advised the appellant accordingly. The Romero case out of San Antonio, the defendant stated that the trial counsel never advised him that he would be deported. The trial court's admonishment is insufficient for the deportation consequences included here. It's not an ABS 91 situation except for the admonishment. The Continental Banking case is also, I believe, been accepted by the Court of Criminal Appeals. Because the consequences is truly clear, counsel had his duty to inform of the specific immigration consequences of the different case. And the Alabama State, Alabama Vasquez versus State case at Texas County. The defendant's attorney's suggestion that Vasquez asked another attorney about immigration consequences is insufficient. Facts in our case, which means do not tell me I wouldn't be afforded if I pled guilty to the cocaine possession charge. He said, do not worry, this is getting all recommended with immigration law.
What is the status on the issue of whether Padillo is to be applied retroactively?
That is an issue that counsel and I had a discussion about before court today because I was curious as to why this wasn't raised in this case. I was curious about why the retroactivity issue wasn't raised. And I was informed, and I'll let counsel address that, but I understand it was because my client received a deferred adjudication. It wasn't a final conviction. The status, however, to get to your question, Justice Gardner, is that there is a split on the circuits concerning this at the federal level. There is a split at the state level. Judge Crane from the Southern District of Texas, I believe President Bush appointed him to the bench in the Southern District of Texas, wrote an opinion called Mariquin. And at that time, he states that a majority of the courts have found Padilla to be retroactive. At the federal level, there is a case called Hong out of the 10th Circuit, which says Padilla is not retroactive. There's a case called Horacio out of the 3rd Circuit, which says it is. It'll reach there probably next year. And the Court of Criminal Appeals had a chance to address it recently, and they chose not to. I think they're waiting for one of the cases that I'm keeping my finger crossed that I get the chance to argue on one of mine that I have up there. I have two.
So does it seem like they might come out with a decision that would help us out anytime soon?
No, I don't think so. I think, yeah, and if they do, I would suggest that the analysis that Chief Justice Chu gave in De Los Reyes, and the Court of Appeals, the First District in Czechoslovakia, they correctly set the standard that Padilla does not establish a new rule, but merely an extension of the ineffective assistance of counsel to immigration facts. And it simply took Strickland versus Washington and says this applies to immigration also, despite the fact that most of the states and most of the federal courts had held that immigration advice was a collateral consequence. There are states, New Mexico has been on the books for years, that you have a duty to advise. And I think I may have answered your question, but I'm not sure.
Thank you very much.
Was there any fact issue as to when counsel advised Mr. Moreno that he had the right or should seek additional counsel regarding the immigration consequences?
The trial counsel's affidavit seems to be that conversation was held prior to the time they did the plea.
Okay.
Mr. Moreno doesn't disagree with that. It's simply a matter of what their conversation was. He says that my lawyer said if they try to deport you, I'll give you the name of a lawyer. Irrespective, the advice wasn't clear, concise, and explicit, and it has to come from the defense counsel. It can't come to somebody that you recommend that they go see. Yes, ma'am.
Well, it can. It would seem that possibly it can if it's not clear and concise. Your position is that in this fact pattern, it is clear and concise.
It's clear, concise, and explicit in virtually every drug-related offense. There are areas of gray when we get into theft cases. which are called crimes of moral turpitude. There are areas of grace sometimes in other circumstances. It depends upon what's the status of the client, how many years has he had that status, if he has status at all, and the nature of the crime. And it's simply a matter of having those facts, which ought to be on any lawyer's intake sheet, and looking at the immigration books. Justice Stevens, in the Padilla case, stated, this is not a hard case to find deficiency. Neither is this. This is a case that the statute's clear.
How do we get around the trial court's findings of fact and conclusions of law, which go the other direction?
The trial court did not make an adverse credibility determination in this case. And with respect to anything that matters, the trial court adopted the position that talking about possible immigration consequences is sufficient, and they took a blurb out of the Padilla case that says that the defense counsel has a duty to warn of the risks of deportation. The De Los Reyes case, the Tonkslovakia case, the Salazar cases, they all talk about how the bright line test is when it's succinct, clear, and explicit. And that's what the trial court hung its hat on, and I feel badly that I didn't do a better job lobbying Judge Stearns on that, because I felt that I didn't think this was a hard part. I thought when you get to the prejudice, that's when the issues are. And with the court's permission, I'd like to address that briefly.
Your time is now up.
You'll my goodness.
You'll get to address it on rebuttal. It's the state's opportunity now. Thank you, Mr. Burton.
Thank you.
All right, Ms. Jacobs.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Andrea Jacobs, and I'm here on behalf of the state, the appellee in this matter. Before I get into my arguments, I would like to point out one thing. I do disagree with counsel that there was an adverse credibility determination when Judge Stearns made the finding that appellant's affidavit was inconsistent with the actions that he did at trial, that was an adverse credibility determination. Appellant argues that Padilla requires that you find that the trial court improperly found that Honorable Don Gandy provided adequate representation prior to the Padilla holding, because he advised appellant to contact an immigration attorney. Well, the state submits, you don't even have to get there. The state submits that appellant has failed to prove the second prong of Strickland. Strickland v. Washington requires two prongs. First, deficient representation, which Padilla v. Kentucky does encompass, and the second prong, how he was harmed but for counsel's advice. In cases of pleas, Ex parte Moody discusses that harm as he would not have pled guilty but for the advice of counsel and would have insisted on going to trial. In Padilla v. Kentucky, they even discuss that, and they use the terms whether the plea would have been rational under the circumstances. The trial court in this case did make findings that appellant failed to prove that he would not have pled guilty but for counsel's advice, and the state submits that this is reasonably supported by the record. This court is required to give due deference to the trial court's fact findings. That is, it should not be overturned absent a clear abuse of discretion, and that there should be great deference towards those trial court's findings of fact and conclusions of law. To make this determination, this court should consider the evidence in the light most favorable to the trial court's ruling. Here we have Don Gandy's affidavit. The trial court adopted Don Gandy's affidavit, and though there was not a specific, I find this affidavit credible, he based his findings on that affidavit, which would suggest that he did find that affidavit credible. In that affidavit, Honorable Don Gandy said, I told him I wasn't an immigration attorney. I gave him the name of an immigration attorney prior to pleading guilty, and the number of that immigration attorney, and he never called him, and he pled guilty anyway. That action would suggest that immigration and consequences was not important to appellant. In addition, the trial court orally admonished appellant and said, you understand that you could be deported as a result of this plea, and appellant said, yes, sir. And with that in mind, do you still wish to plead guilty? Yes, sir. With these facts, the trial court found that, yes, this was a could-be, not a would-be, but that since appellant never said, wait, I'm kind of concerned, is this a big deal? Is this something I should look forward? Didn't make the phone call to the immigration attorney, even though he had it, that these actions were adverse and inconsistent with appellant's affidavit saying, I would not have pled guilty had I known. All he had to do was make a phone call, and he didn't make that phone call to find out if he would be deported as a result. Therefore, the trial court chose to believe the affidavit of the attorney and found that the affidavit of the appellant was inconsistent. I believe that that is akin to making a negative credibility determination. Recently, the Dallas Court of Appeals had two cases. One was Ex Parte Hamid, where they discussed all these cases that appellant's counsel has presented you, talking about granting relief under Padilla. And they pointed out in Ex Parte Hamid, and it's not in my brief, I'm sorry, I can provide that in the letter brief if needed, that none of these had a negative credibility determination. And I submit that we do have that here when the trial court made a finding that appellant's affidavit was inconsistent with his actions at the trial, at the current time of the plea. So viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to the trial court's ruling, the fact that Don Gandy said, hey, I'm not an immigration attorney, and this was before Padilla, and he said, here's the name of an immigration lawyer, call him, ask him, find it out. And appellant didn't, but still pled, I think those are sufficient facts to base the trial court's ruling, to find that the ruling was reasonably based, that he failed to prove that he would not have pled guilty but for counsel's advice.
But that requires us to skip the first step in the Strickland analysis. So that would leave the trial courts in our district in an uncertain situation as far as how this court would apply the Padilla ruling.
Well, I think in this case it's not needed, the first prong, and unfortunately since the second prong does resolve it, you don't need to get there. Regarding the trial courts and a reasonable position, a delicate position, unfortunately Padilla is in a delicate position right now. There's so many different interpretations going on, and since the Court of Criminal Appeals has not made a ruling on this, I think it's still all up in the air. I know other courts have found that, that Padilla is retroactive or whatever, these are clear and concise and succinct, I think is the terms he used, and that, appellant's counsel would be deficient based on those cases, but I think those cases are different because we do have that negative credibility determination by Judge Stearns that the affidavit was not credible. He does not use those words, but he does say it's inconsistent with appellant's actions. If this was a situation where we didn't have, where Don Gandy went that extra step and said, hey, call this guy, here's his number, look it up, then I think you might have a better case to look at and make that determination. But right now we've got where appellant, his affidavit is his only evidence that he would have pled guilty, that Don Gandy's information was incorrect, and I don't think you should get there because based on that.
What about one or two of those five cases that we already have in Texas? They talk about the fact that telling a client to pursue other immigration advice is insufficient, that the attorney has a duty to provide the advice himself.
I think under Padilla that does make sense. But here's also, I know we talked about how it's not retroactive, that, counsel discussed that. But this is not a retroactivity like a Teague situation. I think this is a retroactivity like a Strickland. I really don't think Padilla applies to this case because it did come out before Padilla, but for a different reason. It's long been held since Strickland v. Washington that we hold a counsel only to the representation that effect at the time of the representation. As recently as 2007, Ex parte Romer, the Court of Criminal Appeals held that advice based on existing case law and legal authority at the time of the plea is not ineffective assistance of counsel. And and at the time of Don Gandy's representation, yes, I understand they say Padilla now is an old rule to new facts. The reality is that the case law at the time said, no, you don't have to advise. And so I believe that at the time, Don Gandy thought he was going one step above and beyond what he needed to do by saying, hey, here's this guy, give him a call and find out. So I don't think a Padilla should apply based just on the Strickland case law, not under a retroactivity Teague balance, as all the other courts have done, but based on the fact that we look at an attorney and what they've done at the time, based on the case law at the time. There's other case law, the Court of Criminal Appeals and Ex parte Chandler. A bar card does not come with a crystal ball attached. At the time he gave this advice and said, hey, call this immigration attorney, the rule wasn't that he had to tell him. And so he thought he was going one step above and beyond, I believe. And always, all the way back to 1972, the Fifth Circuit said, of course, counsel's inability to foresee future pronouncements by the court does not render counsel's representation ineffective, nor does a plea later become invalid, because it is predicated upon advice correct at the time, but later proved to be have been erroneous by reason of a subsequent decision. I think Padilla v. Kentucky was a subsequent decision, and yes, I understand the retroactivity of the Teague, but this is a separate issue. This is, at the time, a defense attorney did not have to give advice this specific, you could be deported was sufficient, 2613. The case law we have case law from the Court of Criminal Appeals prior to Padilla that said that you were not ineffective for failing to tell him he could be deported. That's all changed, I understand that. But at the time, that was what Don Gandy knew. And so I don't think you cannot find someone ineffective because the subsequent case law, it changed. And so based on the existing case law, like Ex parte Romer talks about, I don't think he should be found ineffective. But again, I don't think we should get there because I think based on the harm analysis that he has failed to show harm, we don't need to even decide on the first prong. Also regarding the second prong, I'm sorry, was there something else?
No.
Okay. Regarding that second prong, Padilla specifically, didn't make a decision on that second prong of harm. Padilla said, we'll remand it back. You decide on harm now. So Padilla didn't, there was no decision on harm. All these cases, yes, they've made decisions on harm. And we talked about, I think it's different because we have a negative credibility determination here with the trial court's findings. But also, Padilla does say that the plea has to be rational under the circumstances. The trial court didn't make findings about the underlying offense and the facts about it. However, there is evidence in the record to suggest that even a plea of not guilty would not have been rational under the circumstances. Don Gandy explained why appellant pled guilty. The state was considering reindicting on a higher charge. He was indicted for possession with intent to deliver of 4 to 200 grams. He pled to count 2, which was just possession of 4 to 200 grams. That was his plea. He got a lower deal. He got a second degree as opposed to a first degree. However, the state was considering reindicting him for possession with intent to deliver for over 400 grams. Because, as talked about in my brief, the facts of the case and from Dan Gandy's affidavit, he was found with, they watched him deliver 1.5 kilos of cocaine. The state was not intending, the state was thinking about reindicting. They weren't offering anything but pen time. All the plea bargain agreements between the state was, we'll only offer pen time. This was an open plea to the trial court, and the trial court's the one that decided the deferred adjudication. So when appellant argues that he could have received a safe disposition, an immigration disposition, the state wasn't offering it. There's no evidence in the record to suggest that. What the evidence in the record suggests is that the state was going to go after a super first degree, probably I think it's a minimum 15 years, and so there's no way that they were going to work a deal out. And Gandy's affidavit says that, which the trial court, basing its findings on Gandy's affidavit, must have found Gandy's affidavit credible. Also, we have evidence of the facts of the case. It was a sting operation. So the testimony at trial would be police officers. Appellant never alleged what defenses he had or how he could have been successful at trial. If he went to a jury trial, he couldn't have gotten deferred. The only way he could have gotten deferred was to go, he pled to the judge. So to insist that he was going to go to trial on this case when he had no, there's no evidence of a defense, and that the officers, they even found in the indictment, he was indicted for 4 to 200 grams. That was the amount found in his home, of which the officers had a search warrant for that, and he led them to the information. So there's no evidence that even he would have a defense on that particular one. He may have had a defense with the larger amount because of the facts of the case, but he was indicted on that lower amount, and there's no evidence he would have, that he had a defense that would have prohibited him from ultimately being deported. So there's no evidence that the state would have offered a safe immigration disposition because they were reconsidering reindicting. They were considering reindicting him on a more serious charge. There's no evidence he had a defense at trial, and there's no evidence that not pleading guilty would have been rational in the circumstances. Therefore, the state submits that appellant has failed to prove that second prong, and because he's failed to prove the second prong, he's failed to prove ineffective assistance of counsel underneath Strickland v. Washington. Are there any other questions? Yes, sir.
In the affidavit of Mr. Gandy on the first page, it says, I was detained by Jose Marino to represent him shortly after his arrest.
I don't have that information. I don't know. I can check that information. And since it wasn't really relevant as we treat retained and appointed the same way with the ineffective assistance, I didn't look that up. I do apologize. But I can do a letter brief explaining that today. I still would like to submit that I don't think that would be relevant to his ineffective assistance unless, is it to a credibility determination on his affidavit? Or what, sir? Or just kind of an interesting...
One of them didn't write there, and I was looking at your argument on credibility, and
I got
that there is a difference.
Thank you. I understand. Anything else? Well, I know I have a couple more seconds, but I'll just... Where four premises considered, the state will ask that you find that the trial court did not abuse its discretion in denying the writ of habeas corpus based on that second prong. The state is not conceding the first prong, by the way. We're just saying you don't have to go there and affirm the lower court. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Jacobs. Mr. Spurgeon.
I don't know the answer either, Your Honor, but I'll find out. The prejudice. As counsel has done a good job of explaining, one prong of Strickland is generally not gotten to if the other prong isn't met. And prior to Padilla, we didn't have a body of law that dealt with what prejudice meant, because nobody ever reached the first prong, because they wouldn't reach the second prong because they couldn't reach the first prong because there wasn't constitutional deficiency. Since the Padilla decision has been issued, these five courts of appeals, this your sister courts of appeals, have determined prejudice in facts not dissimilar to the ones we have here today. And each one of those lawyers were faced with the same body of law and the same ethical considerations as the lawyer in Jose Padilla was. And our Supreme Court has held there is a duty. Now, I know it may be inconvenient, and it may be different than how we've been doing things before, but the Supreme Court was clear on this point. A lawyer has a constitutional duty to tell his client the truth, and maybe yes, maybe no doesn't cut it. With respect to the prejudice prong, I'm going to commend to the court's attention, and I will provide a copy with the clerk. There is a law review article by Professor Jenny Roberts. She's with the Washington University's College of Law with American University of Washington, D.C. It's called Proving Prejudice Post Padilla. And what she talks about is, what does prejudice mean post Padilla? You see, the state today talked to you about the strength of the government's case, how strong the government's case is, and in cases that are not failure to warn cases, other kinds of ineffective assistance of counsel, the strength of the government's case is an important thing to know. But it's got no bearing in a case with ineffective assistance of counsel for failure to warn, and let me tell you why. It doesn't change the facts. Any good prosecutor will file a motion in limine to make sure the jury never hears about deportation for life, removal from family, separation from kids, loss of livelihood, banishment from the United States for the remainder of their life. Why? Because it's not relevant. That's why these five courts addressed prejudice in terms of, did you give up an important right, a structural defect such as a right to a jury trial? And Mr. Moreno did that. And when we talk about what's rational, I suggest to you that the Supreme Court gets it right. There's a case called St. Cyr, which is cited in the Padilla decision. And it says it is oftentimes rational for a person to risk serious time in prison for at least the opportunity to stay in the United States. And there is a court case out of the Third Circuit, the Orosio case, which goes into great detail about how the guy would have been rational for him to risk it, okay, no matter what the odds are, for at least for the chance. And for those of you that have practiced law in criminal courts and as a prosecutor that I've been, elected prosecutor, and as a defense counsel, all kinds of deals are cut after juries are selected. All kinds of deals. The Supreme Court cites the case Janvier versus United States in Padilla, where they found ineffective assistance of counsel because the lawyer didn't go to the judge and ask for an immigration safe disposition called a JRAD. Well, the JRAD was abolished in 1997, but it's not that the judge would have given it to him, it's the fact that he didn't ask. And that's what happened here. Mr. Gandy, from what I've heard, is a very, 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 very good lawyer. And you can't tell me that had he known this man who got a deferred was going to be deported from his wife and from his kids and from his job for the rest of his life and could never come back, he wouldn't have gone to the DA's office and tried to resolve this into an immigration safe disposition. And that's what Padilla talks about, and that's what Justice Stevens says we have a duty to do, that a lawyer has a duty, cited in the Padilla opinion, where these kinds of negotiations to avoid immigration consequences can benefit the prosecution and can benefit the defendant. And that's what wasn't done here. And that's why there's prejudice. Irrespective of the strength of the government's case, Mr. Moreno should have known to be able to make a choice. And he didn't know he was giving up everything by pleading guilty and receiving a deferral. He's probation eligible. Could have got that from the jury. And that's why prejudice applies. Because it's not a matter of the strength of the government's case. That may be a factor. But he's got to be told the truth. And that's why each one of these cases is kind of skimpy on the prejudice part. And it's skimpy on the prejudice because Justice Chu says prejudice is presumed when you give up your right to a jury trial. My time's up. I thank you so much. I respectfully request the court rule in favor of my client. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, Mr. Spurgeon, Ms. Jacobs. We appreciate both your arguments today and all of your extensive briefing in this matter. It's greatly appreciated. Your case is now submitted, and we will excuse and adjourn court.
All right. Now we will call the field for a second meeting.
I didn't put things up.